Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned on a beautiful blue sky day here in Carborough, North Carolina. We couldn't ask for a more lovely day, and I couldn't ask for a more important and friendly guest than Michael W. Cotter, retired ambassador, lifetime member of the Foreign Service of the United States of America. Michael, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Bill. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Good. Well, I'll tell you, how many times have we done this? 20, maybe?
Well, I don't know. I see where they're finally going to do something with the old corner where the station used to be some time ago, and that must be two locations ago.
Oh, okay. Are they going to do over across from the Weaver Street Market?
Yeah, there was at least something in the paper that something may happen.
We started there, that's right. The roof was leaking and so forth, and then we moved to another place, which is gone.
Yes, it must be, what, six, 7 years?
Yeah, I guess so. I tried to go back and find the first. I got some of my notes here from our conversations, but I don't know how far back they go, so I'm not going to waste our time with that today. I want to spend more time with you. And his history is long. His service to the country is long. He started this whole thing at Stanford University. Then he went to Michigan. Then he went to Georgetown. And then he went to Vietnam, I guess.
Went to Vietnam.
quadruple places you.
Well, the others were school, of course. Vietnam was a school, but a different sort. So.
I guess so. Well, anyway, we talked about a lot of foreign issues, but as I said to you out in the lobby, one thing I'd like to find out about you and your world is you've been to many places, but let's say you're now in Turkey, and there are representatives of the Foreign Service of China in Turkey and France and the Great Britain. How do you people hobnob with each other? Do you know what each other's up to, or how do your relationships work among Foreign Service people representing a variety of countries with a variety of motivations?
Well, diplomatic life involves all the diplomats in most countries.
We diplomatic can talk about life this involves more. All the
yeah we most groups. We spend a lot of time with each other. At social events, if nothing else. But there are gradations of this. So it also depends on the size of an embassy. Now, we've gone over my posts various times, and none of them were on the cocktail party circuit. But that doesn't mean there aren't cocktail parties. For instance, every country that's represented in another country has a celebration on their national day.
Okay.
Now, sometimes these are evening events, although that's much less common now. So more often there's something in the middle of the day, a cocktail reception. And so every country is invited to your national day. For the United States, we generally still do these. We do them on the 4th of July. It's a big community event. And we invite all of the countries with which we have diplomatic relations.
Including the country that you're in. Like when you were ambassador, do you have people from Turkmenistan coming to these?
Oh yes. And that, again, depends a lot on the country. For instance, in Turkmenistan, or when I was in Zaire, it was a gauge of the relationships with the host country. You'd send out invitations to a lot of people, and then you wait to see who could come. Because in some of those countries, government officials would have to get permission to come to the reception.
I see.
Well, if relations were good, you got a good turnout. If relations weren't so good, you got a poor turnout. But the whole diplomatic community was invited. Not necessarily all the members, but at least the ambassadors, and usually more people than that. So you meet at these things in a country that has, let's say, 150 embassies. You're at one of these things practically every other day. In a smaller embassy, not so many, but you still meet people there. You meet all the diplomats at all of the various government receptions. For instance, on State of the Union messages in the United States, we invite, I think all ambassadors are invited. I may be mistaken.
To Congress to listen, sit there? And listen. Oh, okay.
So that's another opportunity to meet. Every time foreign visitors generally come to these countries. The diplomatic corps is dragged out to meet them. So you meet people all over the place. Now, that doesn't apply to countries with which you don't have a relation. So we don't invite Cuba, and we don't invite North Korea, and we don't invite Iran to our receptions. Now, sometimes it gets more serious than that. So, for instance, we're not permitted is a hard word, but we are not supposed to have contact with Iranian diplomats.
Oh, okay.
Or weren't when I was working, and I sure—
Probably still not.
I'm sure it's even tougher now.
Yeah.
And so that means not going up and shaking their hands at a reception. So, I mean, in the bad old days with the Soviet Union, you'd still go up and greet Soviet diplomats uh-huh. and say hi and shake their hand, but you wouldn't carry on long conversations with them. Oftentimes, they would carry on long conversations with you because they would look on it as an opportunity to find out who you were and see whether you were susceptible to being coerced. But with Iranians, in Turkmenistan, for instance, the Iranian ambassador and I both have beards, and so the Turkmenbashi, the president, would love he'd have a reception, and he'd get us up on either side with his arms around us and say, oh, my two bearded ambassadors.
Really?
And we'd both stand there stony-faced, you know. so it was sort of awkward because the Iranian ambassador spoke English. He was a businessman from eastern Iran. I'm told by other diplomats who knew him and his wife that they were charming people. But so you do a lot of work. And with close countries, you do a lot more work.
Well, do you get back on the phone? Do sometimes you get a phone call from a cohort in another country on not a social event, but a question or an international question or something?
Sure, a lot. And particularly when policies change. So whatever country you're in, even if it's not directly involved in this, they're all interested. And so when American policy changes on something, you'll get queries by people at receptions where it's going, what does it mean? And particularly countries that are close to us. We also cooperate in a lot of countries with other countries on specific things where we're in communication. There are a lot of times when we and the European Union have common policies that mm-hmm. we're pushing. And so we'll coordinate what we're saying to the host government about that so that they know that whatever pressure we're bringing on them comes from not from disparate people. We want to have not the same talking points, but we want to make sure we're working together. In Zaire, for instance, which was a former Belgian colony, and even though that had been a long time ago, there were still a lot of Belgians there. The Belgian embassy had a lot better contacts than we did, and one of our main concerns was human rights and political prisoners. And so we worked very closely with the Belgians to know that we were up to date on how many political prisoners there were and who they were. So in that case, we worked very closely together with the Belgians. So it depends on the issue in the country. But, yeah, and you socialize a lot with them, simply out of common interests and because you're not, you know, there are times when you simply want to relax and not necessarily be on your toes at a formal event. So it's nice to sit and relax. Again, in Turkmenistan, where there weren't many Western embassies and there was not very much to do, there was a British ambassador, French, German, English, and then the Pakistani and the Indian.
Uh-huh.
You know, we did a lot of things together. We had all had dachas up in the hills, and
oh, is that right?
And we'd go up on a weekend and you know, have a cookout up at someone's
dacha. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And we didn't do that with the Eastern European ambassadors or the former Soviet ambassadors, most of whom didn't speak English, and I didn't speak their languages, and so it was
before socialize. Turkmenistan, before the Soviet Union, which was out of whatever year that was back in the early part of the 20th century, what were those countries? Those which are now the republics, Turkmenistan and the others. What were they?
They were Soviet socialist republics
before the Soviet Union, though.
They were parts of the Russian Empire.
Oh, they were?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, the Russians conquered that area in the 18th century, and Turkmenistan was the last part they conquered, which was in the 1880s, I think they finally conquered Turkmenistan.
What was what were those countries before they were conquered? Individual fiefdoms?
They were parts of different khanates or emirates. The emirate of khanate of Kiva, and an emirate of Bukhara.
What's a khanate?
Well, a khan is sort of a ruler.
Oh, I see.
Some of them, an emir is a ruler. Khan was a Mongol term that came in with them. So, and some of them were under Iranian rule. Some of them were under Afghan rule. You had a variety of different remnants of the Mongol empire.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I wondered. Well, anyway, I'm glad to get that history because we've never talked about that before, and I just don't know what the life of a foreign service person is among these various countries where you were in South America, of course, several times. So
right.
Probably similar things would be happening there.
Yeah,
as far as your social life and your officialdom.
Yeah, again, I think it's like lots of things in an embassy where there's a lot going on. You see less probably of your counterparts than you do in embassies in countries where there isn't much going on and there's not much social life.
Yeah.
And then you both socialize and have more professional interchange.
Okay. Mary Hope is with us. Mary Hope has a show on Friday at 1 o'clock and repeated on Sunday called Seeking Justice. And Mary may have a question or two for our ambassador. Don't ask too many questions because I've got a lot of them also.
Well, thanks for letting me come on, Bill. Appreciate that, and thank you for being on my show the other day. It was great. And y'all can listen. Still on there. It's you can listen to it on the podcast. Bill had a wonderful show on health care going forward. It's in present time. It was a great show. I was listening to you and thinking of the benefit that you described socially in interacting culturally that ambassadors have, and the need to build more of those social relationships so that we have better understandings of the differences between the American culture and the cultures of all of the countries that we go into. Because it seems as though a cultural misunderstandings lie at the heart of many of our conflicts.
Well, yes. That's, of course, a major part of our training and a major part of what attracts us. It isn't so much the interchange from what you're talking about. It's not so much the interchange with other diplomats. It's the interchange with the culture of the country you're in. Because, of course, the other diplomats come from all over. You do have to be sensitive to basic differences, but that tends to be more back in the days or even today of sensitive political issues. Most foreign ministries would not put the American and the Iranian ambassador next to each other if they had any choice. They would know not to do that. And a lot of the – still today, it is still a very formal profession. So there are all sorts of things that you do. When you are a new ambassador and you come to post, one of the first things you have to do is you have to pay formal calls on your counterparts. Even when I was a junior officer, you paid formal, and your wife in those days paid formal calls on wives, and that meant you have calling cards, and you would go, and you would leave the card, and if the person you're calling on wasn't there, you'd turn the corner over. I mean, this is all in Emily Post's books. This is the way these things were. There'd be a silver salver there in the hall, and you'd leave your card with the corner turned over, because that meant you had made your call and didn't have to do it again. All ambassadors call on those who are there before them. And then once you're there, ambassadors who come after, they make a call on you. Chargé d'affaires are where there's not an ambassador and someone else acting in lieu of. After you've called on the other ambassadors, then all the chargé d'affaires come and call on you. So there's a whole set of formal things that are still done. And communications with governments are still formalized in many ways. And we do a lot of this through things called diplomatic notes, which are formally, and it's the president or the ambassador of the United States of America presents his compliments to the foreign ministry of da-da-da-da and has the honor to, and it goes on in that. So
There's a lot of foreign diplomatic social interactions. You know, but I guess what my thinking was is there a component of being an ambassador in which you are charged or requested to get cultural information about the country in which you are serving and give it back to our government so that we understand this culture a little better?
That's a tough question. I think there are two questions here. The first one, yes, we have the U.S. Information Agency, which is now part of the State Department, Public Diplomacy, and their job is cultural interchange. And they're the people who invite foreigners to the United States. They're the people who run the programs where we send people out for interchanges. And that's what they do. Now, cultural sensitivity reported back to our government, that's part of your business in general, of trying to make sure that our government comports it when they're dealing with another government, comports itself in a way that meets standards.
To promote understanding of that culture would be the objective for me as a person who teaches and studies conflict analysis and resolution. That's a vital component of understanding. Understanding cultural norms.
I think for government to government, the more important things, understanding cultural norms are important. The more important thing that you're trying to do is communicate effectively or get your point across. And getting your point across may or may not require it. Sometimes it requires that you violate those norms, because sometimes it requires that you can't be polite to get your point across sometimes to governments that don't want to hear the point. And sometimes you may be kicked out of a government official's office because he hasn't, or she, although in my experience you haven't had that many women in those kinds of positions of power, because they don't want to hear what you're telling them, but you're required to tell them that.
Tell them that you're not supposed to tell them something.
You're supposed to tell them. If we have a policy that we want communicated, and that may require going in and telling government, this is what we're going to do. Unsaid, you may not like it, or we know you won't like it, but this is what we're going to do.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Well, case in point being the Secretary of State just getting kicked out of North Korea.
Well, no, he wasn't kicked out of North Korea. He was told by the North Koreans to stay off the.
Stay off.
As far as he knows, he's still on it. But this.
Well, they say, you know, he basically insulted them and told them what they didn't want to hear.
That's. Well, no, I think what he did, we've miscommunicated with them, and we've told them things. Not that they didn't want to hear, but that they don't agree where the state of play is. Now, but this administration, as in many other ways, is very different. John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, is well known, has been well known for many years as being someone who breaks these kind of rules and doesn't care. And his point is that he doesn't really care. But this administration has
not
less
worse
of that, partly because the administration has much less professional support since so many senior Foreign Service people have left, so that they don't have the kind of advice, and they don't seem to seek the kind of advice that would allow them to perhaps be more effective in getting the message across.
A shame. Throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
It's going to take a while to rebuild the solid experience structure of the State Department in the next 10, 15 years, I would think, because you've talked about so many people having retired early.
Yeah, well, you lose a lot of experience, it's hard to build that in. I mean, it's good opportunities for more junior people because there will be quicker advancement, but a lot of this comes with having done it for a long period of time.
Stay tuned, folks. You're still listening to us. We're having a conversation. Mary Hope and I are having a conversation with Ambassador Michael Cotter, and there's plenty of things to talk about. You mentioned the word Iran a minute ago, and I noticed today we are talking about putting sanctions on countries that are now dealing with Iran. As opposed to sanctions on Iran, we're talking about putting sanctions on some of the countries that are involved with the oil from Iran. Did you see that? I just saw that this afternoon.
No, but this has been coming. So we've had sanctions on Iran that hit a lot of countries that deal with Iran. So when we say we don't want Iran selling oil, that means we don't want countries buying Iranian oil.
Right.
A lot of countries have agreed to do that, but a number of countries that for other reasons we want to maintain good relations with, India for one, China for a different reason, depend on Iranian oil. And so we have given them waivers from the sanctions. Now, supposedly, the administration is going to start not allowing those waivers.
This would be Bolton, right? Bolton would be probably promoting this kind of thing.
Bolton certainly would be promoting it, and so would Pompeo, all of those people who believe that Iran is a mortal enemy of the United States. So that's the only change. I think there's – I can think offhand of India and China, but Turkey may be another country that buys Iranian oil and badly needs oil. There may be one or two others that are allies. South Korea perhaps was buying oil. And so I gather what we're going to do is tell those countries that that'll no longer be permitted. Well, we'll see how they react. The Chinese, I think, will, you know, ignore it.
Right.
And I'm sure the Indians will come back to us and say, because we have a complicated relationship with India. And my guess is that we'll have made an announcement and won't do anything about it. But it's not clear. With Bolton and others, they'll say, you know, it's time to stop coddling these people. And they believe somehow that if we just tighten the screws a little further, then the Iranians will kick out the Ayatollah and all of a sudden it'll be a modern democracy again.
Oh, well, the Iranian situation is so interesting because many of us who are particularly older, who knew friends from the past who grew up in Iran, have no friends who's children of missionaries or foreign service people who went to school as youth in Iran, and it was a very friendly place to live, and the Iranian people and the Americans were all social friends, but that's all gone now because of the kind of structure we have between U.S. and Iran. So anyway, there was a lot of other issues that are going on. The Sudanese seem to be unable to quiet down their various types of rebellions. I don't really understand that, the two countries, the Sudan and South Sudan. And South Sudan seems to be always in turmoil. I don't know whether North Sudan is or not, but South Sudan seems to always be in turmoil.
Well, the problem with South Sudan, part of the problem is creating new countries where there's no there makes it very difficult. So, I mean, South Sudan, for geopolitical reasons, we were happy to support a rebellion to separate that part of the country from Sudan. And most of that had to do with the fact that oil is found in South Sudan and the South Sudanese felt that they weren't getting their fair share of it.
Uh-huh.
It was also a fact that South Sudanese, most of them are Christians. That whole tier of sub-Saharan Africa tends to be sort of desert, and it's herders, cattle herders in the northern part, but it's more greener and farmers in the south, and the southern parts tend to be Christian and the northern parts Muslim. So, but the problem is when South Sudan became separate there, in addition to religious differences, there are also ethnic differences, and there are two major ethnic groups in South Sudan who immediately went to war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
A very vicious, terrible conflict, which is still underway, and all efforts to convince them not to do that have failed. This is, by the way, our baby. I mean, we created it. We sort of don't take responsibility anymore. within Sudan, it's a different thing. What you have is a fellow who has been in power for 30-some years. You had the Darfur Rebellion where a western part of Sudan tried to separate itself, and they're still after the now former president of Sudan on war crimes for war crimes in Darfur. He's finally been overthrown through peaceful demonstrations. Now, one of the questions is this going to end up being like the Arab Spring, where you had the same kind of demonstrations, efforts by some people to put in more democratic governments that ultimately didn't succeed? I haven't read a lot that indicates that most people think there's going to be, in the immediate term at least, a new democratic government, that there will be another millet. There is now the second military, the one military general succeeded him, and the crowds weren't happy, and he left, and there's another general. I think the military will probably rule there for at least the foreseeable future, and it's hard to tell how long the demonstrations will continue. The other case that's similar to that is Algeria.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Where a long-time president who hasn't even been seen in public for five or six years.
He's not well, is he?
No. But what he's been the front man for what they call the power, uh-huh. which is the military and business interests and uh-huh. a variety of things. And it's not clear what's going to happen there either, whether Algeria is a much more sophisticated place than Sudan and probably much more capable of having a more representative kind
Algeria
of government.
Algeria has always seemed, in the last 50 years, quiet and welcoming Westerners?
No, it's been quiet. Its prosperity comes from oil, but it's not after they kicked the French out. I mean, the French-Algerian war was a very bitter war.
When was that?
In the 50s.
Okay.
It was the last – well, I'm going to get in deep water here. I'm not sure. I think Algeria must have been the last of the French colonies in North Africa uh-huh. that it gave independence. And it only gave independence because of a war that the French people finally refused to countenance having any more to do with. So I know, again, a life of diplomats. I know back American diplomats who were there in the 70s were very leery of going out in public. You know, their cars would be spat on, and, you know, there was a lot of petty crime against them. And it's never been very clear to me why, unless Algerians assumed that all of these folks were French and treated them such. So it hasn't necessarily been open to all foreigners. I think it's been open to oil people, but not much beyond that. On the other hand, they're well-educated. It's right next to Tunisia. It does have a big border with Morocco. They don't get along with the Moroccans, but that's that's a territorial dispute.
Uh-huh.
So I think Algeria has a better chance probably of coming up with a better kind of government than it had before. I think for Sudan, that's a less likely outcome.
In the near future, anyway. In the near future for Sudan. The Sudanese seem to be so engrossed, as you had pointed out, in that ethnic struggle between the two competing tribes and ethnic cleansing happening.
Well, and that's a bigger problem in an area like that. So the South Sudanese managed to separate from Sudan. The people in Darfur in the western part of the country didn't succeed. Now, whether this change, whether there are enough Darfurians left to try and secede once again, once central power softens, is not clear. But this is why you have strongmen in so many parts of the world, particularly in many parts of Africa, because you have countries that were cobbled together. They're not cobbled together. The Europeans colonized the area, and they pulled together areas without any sense of either religious or ethnic differences. And so once that left,
once the Europeans
left, you had the first generation were people whose goal was to hold together what they had.
Right.
Right. Again, a lack of knowledge of the culture causing the conflict.
By the Europeans. Sure, right, but the Europeans weren't interested in that when they were seizing colonies.
They just wanted to conquer.
Yeah, I mean, and there wasn't, from their perspective, there wasn't anything there except for resources that Europeans could get their hands on. But that's not only in Africa. It was true in Asia. I mean, Indonesia was controlled by the Dutch up until 1975.
That's
that was
right.
The Dutch East Indies.
Well, right.
The Dutch didn't go there with the thought of I don't think the Dutch even were interested in converting the Indonesians, because I know there still aren't that many Christians in Indonesia.
It's the most populated Muslim state in the world,
right.
I believe.
And there are Muslims and Hindus and a number, and there are some Christians, but not many. So the Dutch weren't much for that. The other Europeans did much more Christianizing of populations.
Well, you talk about the role of terrorism in some of Africa because it seems to be kind of a place of training grounds that most don't get a whole lot of press.
Most of that's in Northern Africa. What happens, of course, is you have rebellions or uprisings that are for a variety of reasons that groups like ISIS and others, particularly where this involves ethnic differences that are both religious between Islam and Christianity, but very often those differences are underlaid by ethnic differences, and so it's a very messy set of things. And so when there is that kind of unrest, it creates fertile ground for ISIS or similar groups to come in. And so that's what we now see in Chad and Mali and a couple of countries. And that's compounded by the disintegration in Libya, which borders.
Oh, yeah, that's a real disaster.
And of course, that was another case where there was no Libya. under the Ottomans, they were three separate
provinces.
And when the Italians had it, I think the Italians divided it into a couple of separate things. And so when it became independent, when the Italians left, you had this conglomeration that didn't belong together. And they're still fighting over it. So a lot of what we're seeing today still, I mean, it comes under different coloration because nobody wants to say it's a tribal thing. And so they put different coloration on it. But that's what's occurring today in Libya.
Wow.
It's what's occurred in Iraq. It's what's occurring in Syria.
Syria, sure.
So all of these are areas where Europeans colonized areas and pulled together groups. The Ottomans were much more astute about this, the way they ran these areas.
I remember you were in Syria just a couple of years or a year before things started to blow up. You had a
5 months before.
Was it five? Okay, mm-hmm. I remember you were going to Syria and you came and then we had a radio show and I thought, this man's just been to Syria. How'd he get out alive?
Yeah, we were there. Well, it was perfectly fine until all of a sudden it blew up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, that's another example of it's like Libya. It's another example of be careful what you wish for. So clearly Gaddafi was not a nice man.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you didn't have the complete disaster you have now.
Sometimes nice men kind of keep things quiet.
Yes, and that's good or bad.
I mean,
you look from
sure.
it and say, well, yes, but what they're doing is sitting on all of these people yearning to be free.
Right.
Syria is the same kind of thing. You know, I'm not very, very PC on this because I think it was a mistake to try and overthrow Assad in the first place.
Yeah.
I don't think what you were going to end up with was a very conservative Sunni government, Muslim Brotherhood. And what that would mean is that the 10% of Syria that's Christian, those people would all have left. They would have been forced out.
Mm-hmm.
Other minorities in Syria would have been forced out. I mean, what's kept Assad in power is the support of the minorities in Syria. And Syria was, when we were there, was the last of the secular states in the Middle East.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And, of course, Sunni Muslims didn't like that.
Uh-huh.
And their revolt, I think, began as perhaps heavy-handedness on the part of the Syrian government, but what underlay it was a much more serious division between both sects of Islam and resentment, and the result of what had happened in other places, and influenced by the Saudis and support for a much more conservative type of Sunni Islam than perhaps had been practiced before that.
The Saudis seem to have their tentacles in a lot of places. I'm going to mention, by the way, we've missed our station break, so I'll give it to you right now. You're listening to WCOM. This is your voice in the community. WCOM is supported by people in this very community and people elsewhere, and we are really grateful for that support. Without it, the lights would not be on here, and you wouldn't have such terrific shows as Seeking Justice or Time Out. But I would like to mention that you can go to our website, WCOM.com, or .org, I mean, and make a safe and secure donation, tax deductible. You can stop by here at the station. We're attached to the front of the world-famous Art Center in Carrboro. And you can slip a check in an envelope under the door, and we will give you credit for that. And I want to thank you for that support. I'll mention toward the end of the show some of the individuals or groups that support this particular show. But tell me what's it like to be in Parliament these days.
Which Parliament?
In Britain.
Oh, in Britain.
As they're all shouting at each other.
You know, it's just amazing. You know, there's a lot of talk about the threats to democracy, and we talk about it here, but you talk about it in Britain, and when all civility is lost and all sense of common life, common benefit goes away, and you see that in Great Britain. I mean, the sides are so divided on that there's no middle left any longer. And the political parties seem completely incapable of coming to grips with this or changing the route that they're on. The left wing has elected someone who is a radical left wing person.
Now that's the guy that this Jeremy Prime Minister
Corbyn
was going to visit with.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and you know, and then that party is having problems with accusations of anti-Semitism. So it's hard to see any center in Great Britain, and it's hard to see much of a solution that will satisfy anybody. You know, you damage a body politic like that, and it's sort of scary to try and put it back together.
Well, do these delays, which they keep getting, indicate that the whole idea is going to drift off back to what it was?
Well, I mean, sensible people don't want it to happen. Sensible people didn't want it to happen in the first place.
Right.
And
but this was a public plebiscite.
And Prime Minister May's predecessor he was not forced to have that referendum.
Yeah.
He chose to do so.
Yeah.
And a very focused minority, took it over. And they got a result they didn't want. Now, I won't draw a parallel with the United States, and our last election, but you know, I mean, you see the same result here, don't you? A bit, and a loss of any sense of civility.
But I don't understand the relations between Europe and between the European Union, and I guess it's mostly economic, but what is going on now in the relations between Britain and the other European countries that are in it? It's still functioning, right?
Yes, it's still functioning. But, of course, the players in it all have to start planning for something else. So that means the companies that import and export things and the companies that do that importing and exporting and the banks. If you're a foreigner living in Great Britain, you're on short notice because part of what Brexit wants is to get foreigners out of Britain. A lot of international business, particularly financial business, have their European headquarters in Great Britain, and they don't know what to do. I think the goal is that somehow May will find a way to have her controlled Brexit occur.
Yeah.
But she has not gotten the votes in Parliament for that. They've rejected it three times. Whether there's any way they will accept it is not clear. So she's been given more time and much more time to make that happen. And that makes the Brexiteers unhappy. One of the things that's coming up are elections for the European Parliament.
Uh-huh.
And Great Britain is still in the Union. And
okay.
So they will have to run elections to send people there. Well, the Europeans aren't looking forward to the result, and the Brits aren't looking forward to carrying out the election because all it's going to do is exacerbate what's happening in Great Britain. So people keep kicking the can down the road in the hope that some miracle will happen, and maybe it will be another referendum, although I think...
Well, that's what I had kind of hoping for as an independent. I read about the possibility that you just mentioned.
Well, but of course, what that's going to do is harden both sides. And then the question is, you know, the Brexiteers didn't win by much.
No, that's right.
But the question is, if you do another referendum, is the result going to be any better? Or maybe at best it will be 51% against leaving and 49% for leaving, and then where are you? You know, nobody is figuring if they have another referendum, there will be a landslide of 80% saying,
right,
let's stay in
right
the European Union.
Yeah.
So at best you'll have a referendum and you'll have – you'll either have the same result – and you'll have to then go back to saying, okay, how do we do this? A hard Brexit with no plan is a real disaster because you have to plan for this kind of thing. But yet the Brexiteers are not in favor of a soft Brexit. I don't think anybody knows, and my guess is most people in Great Britain are saying they're saying the same thing we're saying. Who knows where it's going to go? So the obvious answer is you kick the can down the road and hope something will happen in the future that will change people's minds.
One of the nice features of having Ambassador Cotter here is other people have questions, and now we have our friend Rocco, who hosts the Saturday morning show, The Music Hall, from 9 to noon every Saturday, listened to by thousands worldwide. Go ahead, Rocco.
Bill, it's always a pleasure to be on with him. Ambassador Cotter, always a pleasure with you on the air here.
Well, Rocco, it's always nice to see you.
Thank you. Mike, what do you think is the main reason why the MP, the members of Parliament, and the half of the population of the UK, the United Kingdom, want to leave the EU? What's the main reason, would you say, behind all this?
Well, I think a lot of the benefit from the union for Great Britain has gone to the cities. And so I think a lot of this is a separation of views between the cities and the prosperous, those people who benefit from it and those people who haven't benefited from it. Again, I think not unlike what's going on in our country. You also have, I think, the pressure on immigration. And that comes as one of the impacts of the Syrian and the Iraq conflict and the number of refugees, and not only those conflicts, but the Libyan conflict, although it's not so much Libyans trying to get to Europe, but it's sub-Saharan Africans for whom the chaos in Libya allows them a way to get to the Mediterranean. You know, Europe has always been a magnet for immigrants, and actually Europe needs immigrants. A lot of Europe's demographics are much starker than ours in terms of
aging population.
Yeah. But again, that brings up the kind of conflict that I think is occurring here too, although we still sort of push it under the rug, and that is, you know, the white civilization losing out kind of thing, I think, is very active in Europe. You certainly see this in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as bad as Brexit is for Europe, what's going on in Eastern Europe is even worse. I mean, you have countries in Eastern Europe which simply now are defying the rules under which they came into it. And what makes that even more complicated is that some of that's religious. Uh-huh. Some of that are Catholic countries, or at least more religious countries, looking at Western Europe, which they see as secular and non-religious, and saying that this is not the kind of a group we want to belong to. And then, of course, what comes out in a place like Poland, once again, is anti-Semitism, which in much of Eastern Europe has not ever been very far below the surface. So, I mean, what happens now, it's analogous to what we just talked about is happening in countries in Africa where ethnic and religious differences are coming to the fore that have been sort of, you know, tamped down for a long time.
Well, if someone can immigrate and get into an EU country, they then can go to any other EU country.
Is that correct?
In theory.
In theory, yeah. They can. And one of the problems is Germany recognizes that it needs immigrants because Germany has a real labor problem. For others, it's very complicated. I mean, I don't know how many Brits have immigrated to the EU. I think many fewer. What you've had are waves of Eastern Europeans emigrating to Britain. And
Britain
then
has a lot of Muslims, isn't that true, in Birmingham or some of those cities?
Well, none of many is. I think France has most Muslims.
Well, that's what they have, like,
but
section,
that's like 10%.
Right.
So we're not talking about, you know, Islam taking over any European country. For the Brits, it's more complicated because, of course, they've allowed people from the former empire to come. So you have millions, or at least hundreds of thousands
from India
of Indians
like
and Pakistanis, yeah, and Nigerians and other former colonies of Britain who have settled in Great Britain for generations. So most of those people are not new immigrants. But, you know, you go to every small town in Great Britain and there's now a kebab house. People like them. The food's cheap, but, of course, the little restaurant that does mash and bangers and mash doesn't like it because it's competition.
Yeah.
And it's seen as foreigners taking over. I mean, you see this in Paris. You see it all over France, of kebab shops and things opening up. I mean, these people are good. They come and they work and they create new jobs themselves. But other people who've lived comfortable lives don't like it. So I don't see a happy ending for this in the near future until, and this includes us, and we have to figure out who we are as a country and what we want to be as a country and whether we want to be somehow an image of what we were 100 years ago.
Which was a white American country.
Which was white America.
Yeah, right.
And white Americans were perfectly happy.
Uh-huh.
Nobody else was. And certainly African Americans were worse off. But I mean, we're still dealing with this in white America of recognizing exactly what was done to African Americans. The whole slavery thing. I mean, we still really have not, as white Americans, come to grips with slavery.
I know. Now we're talking about reparations, which is kind of new.
Well, and that's going to that's going to exacerbate the problem.
Right.
I don't know that reparations are an answer, at least not in any form they've been suggested. What they do is lead to backlash. But I think we haven't decided what kind of a country we're going to be, and I think none of the European countries have decided what kind of a country they're going to be or what kind of a union it's going to be.
Sure, that's right. Well, I guess the boatloads across the Mediterranean have kind of slowed down as far as Syrians or Africans going to Europe and landing on these Greek islands and being shuttled around.
Well, there was a deal between Turkey and the Europeans where the Europeans were going to pay billions of dollars to Turkey to improve the status of the Syrian and Iraqi refugees in Turkey, and that shows signs of breaking down. And the Turks say, wait a minute, you haven't put up the money you said you're going to, and so we're going to start letting boatloads go again. In the meantime, the Eastern Europeans, Greeks and others through whose territory these people go, have strengthened their ability to stop them at the water.
Kind of like Mexico and the U.S., they're building right. fences at the edge of Hungary and some of the right. European countries to keep the Syrians and others out.
That's right. Now, one thing I've read recently where just the last couple of days, now I think this is a trickle, but some Syrians are now moving back to Syria.
I did hear that.
Now, that'll be an issue because I think a lot of those who – I think most Syrians coming back to Syria will be viewed by the government as the return of rebels, and they're going to have to sort that out. But I think once the government is satisfied that it's won, I think they're going to realize they need people. And so, I mean, the hope is that once that war ends, most Syrians want to go home. I mean, most refugees like that
sure.
say,
yeah.
I really would rather be home, but there's no work there, or I'm persecuted there, or whatever other problem is, and that's why I've left. And so the hope always is that when economic and political changes occur at home, refugees will go home. And I think there's some hope for that in the Middle East. I think there's hope for that in Iraq, certainly, where a lot of people have returned.
Well, if I were forced to move to Canada, I'd probably want to come back to North Carolina. Who knows?
Come back to the States.
Well, the climate's certainly better.
Anyway, we have to stop in a minute. I want to thank a few people for supporting this show. I'd like to thank Ambassador Cotter himself, because he's one of our underwriters of Time Out. I would like to thank Tim Hucks. Tim Hucks has a business. He's been on the show many times, and he is a supporter of Time Out through his business, Rising Tide. He's a financial advisor. I would like to thank what's the name of my son's company in New York? MidCap Advisors, who supports Time Out. And I would also like to thank the Ryan Research Center of Durham. They're continuing study of parapsychology and consciousness in the context of the paranormal and exceptional experiences. You can reach the Ryan Research Center by going to their website, www.ryne.org. And do you have a last comment or two, Rocco or Mary, before we thank Ambassador Cotter once again for enlightening us on the world?
Thank you so much, because I have learned so much just from your overall pervasive knowledge. I do have a question. I don't know if it'll take how long it'll take to answer it. Maybe I'll have to have you on my show. But I'm always wondering, as a peace and conflict study professor, about the old system that failed that you remember, called nation building. If we went back, we restructured that program, could we help some of these areas that you've mentioned to build their own countries in a healthy way that respects their own values, their own cultures, rather than trying to impose democracy upon them, let them choose their own way of living? Is there a way we could reinstitute nation building in a more culturally respectful way?
There have to be ways. One of the problems here, of course, is, you know, we talk about nations and we talk about the nation state. And the nation state is a misnomer, at least it has been. Nations tend to be ethnic groups who self-identify. States are political entities, and one of the problems has been that states include other nations. The problem of creating nations that aren't nations is much more difficult than creating a state out of something that's not a state in the long term. It's also very difficult for outsiders to do, as we've proven. I mean, there must be better ways of doing it than we've done, but it's always difficult for outsiders to go into these areas and say, we have an answer, and this is what you can do to better yourself. And what we've tried to do is to show them that democracy, writ however we tend to say the way we do it, which has never been very realistic. The other problem we have on this is that we operate on a 2 or 4 year time frame for how we do programs. If we're going to do any of these kind of things, we have to come up with something and then do it for a generation. And we can't do that. We don't have money for a generation. We have money appropriated every year or every 2 years. And the parties change. And one of the things always is your programs don't work, and that's fine for domestic programs, but your programs internationally don't work either, and so we're going to change things over. So we've done nation building, but when we've tried to do nation building, we've done it 18 different ways in 100 different countries. And it depends whether it's a country we like or a country we don't like, and they're trying to force change on. So there has to be a better way.
But the concept is right. The concept, if not concept passed, but concept redesigned to help put peace back in a region in a different way. I want you to come on my show and talk about it.
I'll be happy to.
I'd love to.
That's
have
a
you.
Topic I enjoy. Anyhow, Mary, very nice meeting you, and I think your show sounds very interesting, and I look forward to coming on it.
I'd love to. I'll schedule you before you
leave. Ambassador Cotter is a great supporter of this station, WCOM, and Mary is a terrific new addition to our more academic and intellectual side of WCOM. And Rocco keeps us grounded in the real life of top music, and Rocco has more underwriters than anybody in the whole world, so Rocco, stay with it. Ambassador Cotter, great to see you again, and thanks again, and we'll be in touch. And don't let Mary steal you away from Time Out.
No way, no, Bill. I look forward to it.
Once.
Thank you.